ABC Listen.
Australia's always been the lucky country, sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
How many times have you checked your phone today? How many tabs are open in your web browser? Have I got your attention?
Sometimes I want to throw my phone in the river. I do think there are less spaces where we can go to really feel solitude and unreachable. I mean, I lived for a year in a shack and there was no phone. I had to go walk like 3 kilometres. The level of agency I had over my life from that perspective was so phenomenal. It would be very hard to do now.
It's something that's always been around, this idea that attention is a commodity and we're trying to get it. But I don't think it's ever been commodified in quite the same way as it is in contemporary society. So your attention is literally sold. When you watch YouTube, you're effectively giving your attention to something and they're then selling your attention to something else. And so everything about our lives is sort of trying to get our attention and trying to direct it in particular ways. So I think that's quite different than historically. It wasn't commodified in quite the same way.
Yeah. The commodification of your attention. Hello, it's Natasha Mitchell. Really pleased to bring you ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. Yeah, we hear a lot about the attention economy now. Your attention is worth something, big bucks in fact. So do you feel in control of your attention? Would you like help? Do you need an intervention? Because confession, I do. Today's live philosophy event from the Sophia Club and the Contemplative Studies Centre at the University of Melbourne is here to help us. You'll hear from Centre Director and Psychologist Nicholas Van Dam. And we're kicking off at the Brunswick Ballroom with meditation teacher and writer Jess Hewen, with Sophia Club host Bridget Haynes, the editorial director of the magazines Eon and Psych, with Eon Media.
Let's start, Jess, with a little bit about your personal journey. You described yourself in a recent letter to your newsletter subscribers as, when you were younger, as a spiritual orphan of modernity. Mm. I thought it was a lovely phrase. Mm. What does that mean, and where did that feeling of being a spiritual orphan of modernity take you?
I suppose as a teenager, it came quite surprisingly, but it began like a whisper. And I really remember it very clearly. It was very visceral and just touching my chest at nighttime. And I was a wild teenager, very explorative. But touching my chest, just going, there's something else. There's something else. There's something else. There's a deeper place or a deeper refuge for my being to land. And there's more to my own mind that I know. But I suppose that orphan of modernity, that it wasn't like there was a clear road for me to try to answer that personal koan I sent, I guess, of something else, something else, something else. Mm. So for a while there, I was sort of flailing with my own being in my own mind, wanting to sort of answer that.
And what were the answers you started to seek then? Where did you go with that?
First, I just went very internally. Like, first, that feeling of that there's something else. I actually did start to, like, ask other friends, or I remember different experiences of people who had religious traditions, you know. So there was some friends that still would go to church, say. Yeah. And so first I remember, like, being very embarrassed by this yearning, you know. Yearning for something deeper, a deeper conversation, but also yearning how to work with my own mind and how to find a deeper place. So then none of that really worked. And then I really just started at nighttime, like in my bedroom, meditating and just sitting there very quietly and just thinking there's more to my mind than I know, and started slowly just slipping into these different states. But it also then just instinctively, I ended up just hearing about Buddhism as a teenager, and I booked a ticket, again, very instinctively, to do a month retreat. And that was the sort of beginning of actually being in a a more of a community or a holding or a body of knowledge that really did speak to me and made sense to me.
Yeah, so your yearning saw an answer in that sense to that yearning in a place, in a tradition.
In a tradition that directed me back into my own being to come into contact with that.
Yeah.
But it was a whisper. It was a very strong feeling. Like it started as a whisper, but then it really was like lava. It was also something I couldn't really describe. Like it was a sort of poetic upsurging that things needed to change.
Yeah.
Because I'd been trying to find...
It wasn't just an intellectual
It wasn't an intellectual thing because I'd been explorative and as a young person exploring different drugs and different substances to sort of exit experience. And I thought there must be another way to actually be deeply in my body and also have a bright attention and be awake to my life without having to...
So you've already used a few words there that we might pick up when we start thinking about attention, that sense of being able to look at your own mind or to attend to your own mind. It's a really curious kind of experience, isn't it? What is it like to attend to your own mind?
I think, again, because now there is there's so much coming at us all the time and there's so many alarming situations that we're all so privy to, the suffering of others that we wouldn't have been so privy to years and years before, there's a lot sort of going on. So the first thing I think, the capacity just to be able to not be in these times in a state of alarm, you know, and to settle down, to have some capacity just to really relax and settle down and then just start looking at experience with more freshness. I think that's the first thing, to be able to pay attention. It's very hard to pay attention when we're really wound up.
So the first thing you're highlighting there is that one of the things that stops us paying attention is our emotions and our emotional state. Like I feel like you're describing something I'm sure everybody's familiar with, I feel very familiar with, which is just being caught on things outside yourself. I mean, I think we all share sort of some concern at least with the amount of input, like the amount of input, the news, the social media, the competitiveness, the constant onness, the sort of work 24/7 email, you know, all this stuff that everybody's very familiar with. It's an old story, but do you feel there is something different now for people in dealing with all the amount of input?
I have. Even in the last 5 years, I've seen that in students and in myself. I feel like because there's more intensity, we also need more skills and more support to be able to settle down and stay grounded. I think that is very overwhelming for a lot of people, and sometimes I worry people come on a retreat and they start to get really rebalanced, you know, and start to feel that, you know, when you settle, you can feel your heart again, you can, your feeling wakes up, you're less numb, and then you send people back into the world where there's so many demands. You know, I feel for that because the context is really, I think the context, it's a tough context in some ways.
I wanted to just dive in a little bit to mindfulness and meditation, because I think we sort of jumble those two things together a bit. I'm really interested to know from you. Well, let's take one at a time. Mindfulness. What does that mean to you, mindfulness?
To me, mindfulness is being aware moment to moment of what's happening in my own experience. So it's being cognizant of what's actually happening. And I said before, I think that it's something that mindfulness starts to refine and we start to be able to register more and more subtlety in our own experience in the service of being able to see, well, what's in my experience is harming me and is compromising me or is weighing me down or contracting me, and what in my experience actually is buoyant, leads to creative thinking, is opening, is more fluid. So there's, mindfulness is being aware of what's happening, and then there's, a way of being mindful.
And mindfulness, from what you're saying, is not like an end in itself necessarily. Is it a pathway to something else?
I think mindfulness is a pathway to something else. Mindfulness, as we start to slow down, right, and we could start to see, you know, sometimes people come on a meditation retreat and they go, oh my God, now I feel more crazy than I did before. Not because anything else is happening, but we're actually starting to see what's going on all the time. So we don't often...
Is that a sense that people might think, oh, now I realise how churned up I am? Or
now I realise low level of anxiety I'm always living with. I walk around with my gut kind of clenched. Or we might go, oh my God, that critic, you know? It's like, it's there the minute I wake up. And you get so intimate with that. So it's first, it's kind of what we may have actually used before to buffer the encounter with the rawness of our experience gets stripped away. So we're left just with the immediacy. But when we start to then get contact with that, we can then start to see and then have a different response. Mm. Like you start to see, oh my God, I've been a lot more constricted by that critic than I knew. Mm. And so then we can apply a remedy to meet that, to hopefully liberate that, to have less self-conscious in the being. Or
I know we've talked a bit, and listening to you really makes this come home for me, how important that community is around somebody who's going through an experience like that. That's a pretty big experience to strip away those defences, really look at your own experience and try and not let it overwhelm you. So how does that work? I mean, you obviously, that meditation retreat is a very structured environment. Is it something people can do on their own, or do you think it really does require connection?
I did it a lot on my own, and I think I did have to then redress too much time doing it on my alone.
Because you've had very long periods of solitary.
Long immersions, which were very compelling and where I really did touch a lot in my experience that I had really wanted to. Anyway, I think to any time that we are held, we just feel safer and our practice will deepen. And also in a retreat, a lot is set up to make those encounters more supported. So you'll begin with a lot of just, as I mentioned before, the settling, the calm abiding, just knowing what it is to get into your body, you know? So then you start to see what's happening with more ground. If you don't have the ground and you're starting to see what's happening, it can be very overwhelming and quite shocking sometimes.
Yeah.
But if you have the ground and you have the encouragement to be kind, which some of us, it's quite hard to sometimes do that, to really be kind.
It's really hard to be kind to yourself,
right? Very, very hard to bring the kindness in and the care. There's a lot of steps you'll do to support that mindfulness to be able to then work with it in a skillful way.
Yeah.
So it's not just, you know, throw in there and strip back. It's like, let's give you the tools to be able to meet your experience wisely, to have some confidence that I can actually, as a human being, like sit with my emotionality. I have some confidence that my experience can feel workable. So there's a lot of scaffolding just to support that, teaching and cognitive understanding, framing.
Because I think we've talked about this sense of being overwhelmed by inputs, but of course we go and get them. I mean, I was thinking to myself recently, what a terrible habit I've got into of looking at emails and messages on my phone first thing in the morning. I'm like,
I know.
My dog is saying to me, good morning. I'm like, sorry, I can't talk to you right now. I've got to check my email. Which is kind of completely the wrong way around. Like, joyously greet the day first, right? Or if not joyously, greet the day at least.
Well, it's a little bit.
But, you know.
It is. It's a little.
He's always joyous, but yeah.
No, I hear you. It's a bit insidious how quickly, with the technology, we will jump to that quickly, that addiction.
Yeah.
And that I do think in these contemporary times, it does take some agency and desire and strength that I want to be able to know what it is to settle and to live maybe deeper than agitation.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That you actually have to have some intention.
We are just, again, saying, well, you know, you can get very hooked on being frenetic and busy.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a retreat where, like, you kind of give the container or box people in. Sometimes it's like a pack of wild horses coming in, you know, and we're all kind of like a bit fried and jumping out of ourselves. Yeah. But if you stay for long enough with yourself, and I often think we don't give ourselves enough time to get to our own goods, which is what all the traditions are pointing to. Actually, there is something in us that's sane, that's deep, that's creative, that's deeper than our conditioning. We can touch in on deeper layers of our being, but so quickly we'll just keep jumping out. Because of course we will. We feel discomfort and we'll quickly jump to something else. But when you're supported to stay and stay and stay and the being starts opening up and softening, it is such a precious thing to watch a human being sort of be restored to a more natural, free mode of being. It is like horses. I feel I get kind of, the second day I'm always like heartbroken because everybody's wigging out, you know, because you can't grab the usual things that you would do to abate that difficulty. But if you can stay through that, it's like everybody starts, settling, and then something more precious opens up.
Yes. I mean, we can't all perhaps go on a retreat or have that opportunity. So tell me a bit more about practices. Like, what kinds of practice are you interested in? What forms of meditation, I suppose, is one way to describe it. But I don't know if that word is big enough. Is meditation a big enough word?
I think, a meditative path.
Practices.
The teachings of the Buddha and the Dharma is a whole, very holistic, integral body of knowledge to embody and live, not just on the cushion, but in our lives. In my tradition, the meditation I'd be thinking about it as in the first thing would be, I mentioned protocols to set up more safer experience or regenerative experience is like an ethical, I'm doing this because an ethical orientation, like right. That would show up in each of us very differently, you know. Right. I want to know what it is to...
This is a very philosophical intention because you say, is this like, how might I live better, the life that I would value?
Yes.
Right, which is a very philosophical notion.
I think so. And we all have light bulb moments of that. Mm. I'm here in this body for don't know how long, literally. Mm. I want to live well. I want to be able to open my heart, you know. I want to be able to pay attention to what I care about. But then again, we're on the phone, we forget, you know. Of course, we all do. So then having a practice that can get behind our ethical intention or our desire, for me, I think that's the meditation practice. Yeah, so you have to have that ethic, you need that drive, that desire.
Yeah.
And then we would have all the settling practices, I said, like the calm abiding, a whole range of practices to help that settling under the turbulence. And then you have practices that are incorporating in a way different ways of seeing, different ways of looking that free up suffering, that lighten the
load.
What
does that mean, free up suffering?
So for instance, so it could be, so on one retreat I had a woman who was, like many of us, just incessantly had that self-attack going on. We'd just be sitting there like, you know, opening the door just to get into the hall. Like, why are you opening the door like that? You shouldn't open the door like that. And slowly, as she got more settled, she could start to see when that thought was coming in. At first it would wind her up, but slowly in time she got less and less identified with it and it no longer had a grip on her. You know, it just started to fall away. And one day she sort of shouted out, you know, the thoughts are coming, but I'm a transparent mountain. They've got nowhere to land. You know, and she was like elated, like I could live without that heaviness on my back. That's loosening up suffering. That's the insight. Sometimes these states of mind or the inner critic, we may be so familiar with it that it feels like it's us. You know, it puts us in a trance. So mindfulness, we're waking up out of the trance to see what's going on and how that's impacting us moment to moment. So liberation from like a difficult state of mind, that it's no longer like, you know, on top of
it's
us.
It's not oppressing us in the same way.
Yes. We're more dancing with it rather than it's on top of us.
Oh, you're not trying to shut it down though? Like,
not trying to shut it down, just start to get, that's what's happening and just starting to see. Just the first thing is just start to see what's happening.
Which takes us back to that notion of attention.
Attention, right. Very much.
I was reading a description by Jack Kornfeld of this meditation of being a tree, which really struck me because we talked a bit about embodied practices. And he describes this idea of you feeling very overwhelmed by what's going on in the world and by climate change and the earth's vulnerability, that you can do this meditation. He takes you through all the steps, which is essentially finding a place to place yourself on the ground and then imagine you are a tree with roots deep in the soil and to feel the sort of power and security of the earth beneath you and these sorts of, and I just thought this is a really beautiful and powerful imagination. What's the role of imagination and visualization in meditation practice? Is that something that you would work with or you've seen in other practitioners?
Essentially how I've been working is more with direct experience.
Yeah.
So it would be more maybe for a while, not following just habituated thinking, not just going with any first thought and coming back into the body and coming back into the breath and just starting to build energy and not leak by just following thought. As that starts to happen, in my experience and as I talk to people, the creativity just starts arising, imagination starts arising, but sometimes just from a less surface level, that's first the quickness, so then natural images.
It's a welling up. It's like a welling up from within. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in that particular way of practicing. There's other visualizations that we could do in practices that can explore, but it's getting out of the compulsion of moving to visualization from a compulsive place. It's again from a bit of a freer place to start to bring that in.
And you're saying that part of that is really attending to the body.
Yes.
It's very important to your practice, the body's feelings and sensations. Because we sometimes think of meditation very in the head, I think.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's maybe a stereotypical view.
Yeah.
But that it's like quite austere and monastic and, you know, really trying to sort of not be too connected to the physical.
Yes. For me, I think it's very much a whole-bodied practice and settling deeper into the body, in the body, the pulse of the present. It's like an anchor to the pulse of the present. It's also touching into the body can help cut through the elaboration of the mind. So sometimes, like, first, if there's a lot of worry, in the body, and then it will quickly go into a lot of quick thinking, like, oh, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, I'm really worried about
catastrophizing.
Catastrophizing, and we could be in a movie that's really winding us up. The body, sometimes you can cut through that and just attend to the shakiness that's underneath that, and through just staying there with kindness, that can leave, and then it can clear up the vista again. But we try to resolve things through the mind. If I can get to the bottom of this and sort this out, then I'll be okay.
You're saying we need to feel it through.
Feel it through. But also, you asked about different meditation practices. I was giving more the classical way of practicing, but I think there's so many ways that we all, formless ways that we all enter a meditative state. And probably so many people, like in nature, or even what, where we fall in when we're in a, with a really dear friend, where we're really relaxed. There's a lot of the dancing, you know. Mindfulness isn't all just dependent on being slow.
Yeah.
But in the beginning stages, it very much helps just to slow things down, because it just helps us see. But in the end game, you could be mindful, like dancing wildly, be very present, or being very slow. So it's not...
There's not one mode.
Not one mode. I think there's a lot of different ways we would all be entering a meditative space, but there is a classical also framework that, that points to certain realizations that will help that freeing up. So, you know, for me, I know walking in nature, like big walks, are so helpful just to settle myself down and open my attention up. I think, and then water, the elements, being around things that are natural, around fire, around rivers, around, you know, big skies. But, I don't know, my brother, though, just loves walking in a city street with just having energy all around him. You know, so I think...
Different energy.
I think we're so particular, and I do think meditation is a wonderful tool to settle down, to start to hear some of those more distinct creative impulses that you could easily push down. Lying outside in the garden for 15 minutes a day, putting your body on the earth, like your belly on it, there's all these things we would inhibit ourselves from doing that could actually really work. So sometimes I think we have to find our own unique solution and trust it.
Yeah. The word came up earlier about, in addition to curiosity, innocence. And I think what you're describing is that, and that joy of kind of creativity and openness and the flow state of childhood and play.
Play.
You know, play. We've talked about play before in the Sphere Club, but that play of creativity. So we're just getting away from thinking there's one little thing called, meditation, sitting on a cushion. Actually, we're just really talking much more capaciously, aren't we, about something that's so personal and so human and so available to us if we have that, we open up that space for it.
Taking meditation beyond the cushion on the hard floor is meditation teacher Jess Hewen. It's a really nourishing conversation today. I hope you're finding that. It's our live event, radio show and podcast with me, Natasha Mitchell. What can meditation, mindfulness and other contemplative practices really offer us, especially in this digital age where attention spans have been fractured? Mine certainly has. And if yours hasn't, can you tell me why not, how you've managed that? Email us, bigideas@abc.net.au. We're at the Sophia Club live philosophy event at the very atmospheric Brunswick Ballroom in Melbourne. And if you swear by a good siesta, you love a good sleep, then psychologist and director of the Contemplative Studies Centre at the University of Melbourne, Nicholas Van Dam, has some good news for you. He's speaking to host from Eon Media, Bridget Haynes.
So I'm curious just to hear a little bit from you about how you've ended up being a specialist in this arena of contemplative practice. What's brought you there?
So I first encountered meditation and mindfulness when I was in my senior year of my undergraduate studies. And we did a MBSR, a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, as part of a course I took on stress.
That's the Jon Kabat-Zinn knowledge,
correct,
right?
Yes. Yeah. And so I was at the University of Wisconsin, which is where Richie Davidson was doing a lot of research, and it was 2005, so a sort of height of the popularity. I think 2004 was the year that Richie Davidson was on the cover of Time magazine. And I remember taking the course and doing the guided practice and having some really amazing naps and thinking, these are the best naps I've ever had in my life. But then I thought nothing more of it.
This is very end of yoga class kind of experiences. was that meditation? Or, no, I'm not sure.
But I remember quite specifically sort of asking about that and thinking that, you know, the response I got was, if you need to nap, you need to nap. And the ability kind of to fall into that sleep. I mean, the states I would wake up in were amazing because it felt as if for the first time I had experienced an ability of going into sleep without all of the constant noise that was in my head. But that was it for me at that point, which was interesting. That was all it was.
Like
it was
amazing naps.
It was amazing naps. And I thought, this is a wonderful trick to have amazing naps. And then I finished and I went off to medical school and I had my whole life planned out as only a privileged, entitled 25-year-old young white man could. And about two-thirds of the way into medical school, like, everything just fell apart. Mm-hmm. My kind of faith tradition that I grew up in kind of didn't really fit anymore. My partner at the time broke up with me. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had this realization. I think I was sitting in an anatomy lab and I was like, well, I don't care at all about the bones of the inner ear.
I mean, it's great that some people do, but
I'm thrilled.
It doesn't have to be you.
I'm thrilled because people have to know these things, right? But at that moment, I was just like, I could literally care less what these bones are called.
Get me out of here.
And I remember as I was sort of doing the studies, I had this really amazing experience. I was quite anxious when I was younger. And we had an exam, and it was the day after I decided I was going to quit medical school. And I literally just looked at it and just went, bubble, 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 I don't care, this is no, you know. And I literally walked up after about 20 seconds and handed it in. And I remember hearing a whole bunch of people in the class being like, how is he done so quickly? And I was like, because I don't care at all. Like, I just failed miserably, and it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
But so what happened after that was I was really left in a scenario of, like, I've got to figure out what's next. And I didn't really know what to do because just I had this plan, and now I had nothing. And so I thought, well, remember those wonderful naps?
Yeah.
Maybe there was something to
that. There's something glowing on the horizon.
And it was nice and it was lovely and there was something to it. And so I gravitated back to it. And as I was sort of learning more about it, I was also reading the philosophy behind it. I was reading philosophy in general. I was reading psychology, just trying to make sense of the world again. And something just kind of connected. It felt right. It felt like that was filling a space in me that I was missing. And so that then set me on this other path to thinking about, well, how do I become someone who gets to do that, who gets to facilitate this in a way that ticks the boxes for me, that helps me understand what's going on in people's minds, that helps comfort people when they're struggling through the kinds of things that I was going through. And so then I went on to graduate school in clinical psychology, and I studied and focused on the ways in which mindfulness-based practices can potentially be a benefit to people with anxiety and depression.
So we've probably all heard at some point sort of stories about the neuroscience of meditation, and it's kind of Tibetan meditators in MRIs and, you know, all that sort of thing. But can we just go back to that question about attention for a moment? What is the view from psychology, from empirical scientific psychology, on the nature of attention? What does attention mean in your world?
So there's two things I think about in terms of attention. One sort of is, and I think we heard Jess touch upon this, but I'd like to elaborate it, because from the psychological framework, there's something really important about the ways in which attention and awareness interact. Mm-hmm. So I often think of awareness as like everything that's available to us as information. And attention, we talk about in psychology, is like a spotlight or a torch where you're shining that light. And so I explained to a lot, or I even did this with my son the other night, who's 8. What you may be attending to right now is maybe my voice or how annoyed you are with it or something else entirely because you were daydreaming and you only now just woke up to the fact that some guy's on stage talking. And then I'm going to tell you now, pay attention to the fact that there's pressure from your seat on your bum. Right? So that was of there in your awareness the entire time, but you weren't attending it. And so it's this interplay of what's in your field of awareness, what's accessible to you, but then there's also where that spotlight of attention goes.
Presumably it'd be kind of unbearable if we were attending to everything all the time.
Of course, we'd be overloaded and overwhelmed by all the information. I mean, there's a ridiculous amount of information that we would have to process, and our brains have adapted a mechanism to be selective about what we do process and how we make sense of it, because otherwise it just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's just like I do have 50 tabs open at all the time.
Yeah, and you can't look at all of
that. That is bad, right?
It's a nice analogy, right? Because it slows your processor down, right? And eventually the computer's going to crash and you're going to lose them all, and you're going to kind of be graceful and grateful that it happened, because then you didn't have to close them.
Exactly. So do you, just coming to this kind of sense of anxiety we have about our attention, like we're distracted and we're sort of so many demands on it, do you feel we are in a sort of moment of an attention crisis? I mean, do you think that's exaggerated? Does that mesh with our anxieties about mental health and anxiety?
I didn't sort of explain the other aspect of attention important, but no, it relates exactly to this. So the other aspect of attention sort of is the neuroscience of it and how it works at the level of the brain. And so there's a very popular model in neuroscience and psychology is that there's three kind of components to attention. One component is what we would talk about as sort of bottom up, like the things that grab our attention, right? So this is maybe a sound in the room. I just heard a cough. We can't help but kind of notice that. It may be our phones vibrating. So this is the stuff that grabs us, and that's really important evolutionarily, right? Mm. If someone came bursting through the door screaming, there may be a threat,
it's
and I need to be aware of that, right?
It, yeah.
Then there's the top-down stuff, which is where do I want my attention to be? Mm-hmm. And there's a difficult interplay between those two things.
Yeah.
And then there's a system in the middle whose kind of job it is to redirect attention or reorient attention. Mm-hmm. So when you've kind of gone off and said, oh, you know, there's a cough over there, but hey, I'm supposed to be having a conversation over here, there's a system that helps you to do that. So then going into your other question about what are we facing in the world with attention and demands, I think attention has always been a commodity, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to look far outside of the animal kingdom to recognize that males have evolved in a way that they display themselves prominently to attract women, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something that's always been around, this idea that attention is a commodity and we're trying to get it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's ever been commodified in quite the same way as it is in contemporary society. So your attention is literally sold. When you watch YouTube, you're effectively giving your attention to something and they're then selling your attention to something else.
Yeah.
So there's algorithms that are sort of deciding how many ads get brought on and how much they pay people. And so everything about our lives is sort of trying to get our attention and trying to direct it in particular ways. So I think that's quite different than historically. It wasn't commodified in quite the same way.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the challenge, is that we feel pulled in so many different directions. And add on top of that the way that news cycles have evolved. Add on top of that the fact that we all have computers in our pockets. We now have access to lots of different information. And in fact, those organizations that are selling our attention have lots of access to us.
We're kind of primary producers, right, who aren't getting paid for our product, which is our attention. Like, we're producing our attention all the time, but as you say, giving it away.
Exactly. But so that's, and that's the product, right? So there's this idea that somehow we struggle with. My 8-year-old son struggles with this all the time. Why do they make content that I can watch for free? The content's free. I'm not paying them anything. It's, well, no, it's because your attention is the commodity that they're interested
in. Your mind.
Exactly.
Right.
So I think that's the challenge. I think we feel as if we don't really have control over what we're attending to because we're pulled in so many different directions. And it can feel as if oftentimes in modern life, I think that we have this experience, which I'm sure people had, you know, decades, even, you know, centuries ago as well, of kind of waking up only to realize that you've been daydreaming or doing something entirely unrelated to what you want to do. But I think it's become more normative. It's become more a part of our lives. And so I think that is feeding into our sense of dis-ease or uncertainty, that we don't really feel as if we're in control anymore.
Which raises that really interesting question of agency over our own minds. We've heard Jess talk about this relationship between becoming aware of what's going on in our minds and feeling that we have more agency to exercise, say, an ethical intention or to express our values. Can we look at that from a sort of psychological point of view? What's going on? And if we think about something like contemplative practice, meditation practice, what is this relationship between attention or our awareness of our own minds and achieving the intentions that we might want to have about our ethical values or whatever? What's the mechanics there?
I mean, the challenging thing is for a long time in neuroscience and in psychology, sort of we played with this idea of the brain as like comprised of specific areas or components that served very discrete functions. So
there's bits of brain that had different jobs.
Exactly.
Basically.
And so we love this idea that like your amygdala is the fear center of the brain, which is actually not true, right? The amygdala is more of a like salience or relevance center of the brain. What's more relevant or salient than threat or fear, right? So that's why the that's why the amygdala is active when there's a threatening stimulus. And then we think of like the prefrontal cortex is like the executor. You know, it comes in and that's kind of us. And that's sort of us brute forcing. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's us brute forcing our way into doing what we want to do. But more recent findings suggest that that's not really accurate, that the brain really functions as a constellation of networks. And these networks are constantly evolving and changing. And I think that's a really important thing to be aware of, because when we think about what's going on in this kind of self-awareness, self-reflection process, or when we think about ideas that we might have about, say, self-regulation, it's really important to ask the question of, who's the self that's doing the regulating?
Yeah.
So it's this idea of, like, when we're trying to look back in on ourselves, who's doing the looking? And I think that's also a challenge from the neuroscience, because as we're looking at what's happening with meditators in MRI machines, or even just asking them as they practice, there is this change where it starts to feel less like, and we see less activation or less separation of areas that would be associated kind of with discrete brute forcing ourselves to stop being afraid or to pay attention to this or that. And the networks of the brain kind of start to reconfigure and talk to each other in different ways.
So fascinating. So in a sense, in meditation practitioners, you are not seeing that the boss of the brain is more in charge, you know, that they're actually, that's not how it's working. You're not getting a top-down control. You're not getting more control over your thoughts and emotions necessarily.
No, in fact,
something else is happening.
What just said, right, and I think this is really important, there's an element of what's happening that initially the practice is incredibly effortful. We have to work really hard to stabilize our attention.
So exercising all this will, basically.
Exactly.
It's very challenging,
particularly if you've never done this before, to maintain your focus on the breath. It's pulled in so many different directions. You keep thinking about, did I have enough to eat? What am I going to do when I get home? Did I say the right thing on the phone? You know, did I respond to that email?
You're making me tense just even saying this.
But I mean, this is a lot of people's experience meditating
for sure.
Is exactly
all
that.
Life, yes.
It's a bit unfortunate because we've been marketed this idea that, you know, we will be calm and we will get headspace, right? And
well, we just sort of empty ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's nothing what most people's experience is like. It's the exact opposite. But as you progress, it becomes less effortful. And one of the really interesting findings from some neuroscience studies is that the different areas of the brain, so there's an area of a network of the brain that's really active when we mind wander. It's called the default mode network. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the area of the brain that kind of just gets lost in thought, and it's like us thinking about ourselves or daydreaming or whatever. And then there's this other area that has parts of the prefrontal cortex. And what's really interesting is that they're typically what people always talk about as anti-correlated, which I think is a strange term, but they're kind of, when one goes up, the other goes down. Mm. What we've observed in a few studies with advanced meditators is that they're talking to each other. So they're not supposed to.
The networks are talking to each
other
in the brain.
Right? So these networks of the brain that normally kind of, one would only be active when the other one wasn't, they're actually now informing one another.
So is that, in a sense, one of those networks is about that kind of focused, I'm getting on with something, I'm doing something kind of that I need to get done, and the other is that wandering open one. And is that a kind of approximation of those two
You could roughly use that as sort of a heuristic. I think part of the idea that's important to acknowledge there is that mind wandering is not bad.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. Kind of our ability kind of to go where things take us is good. And so this idea that, again, kind of going back to the idea of we can brute force our way through it, or you talked about, Jess, it's not just stuffing it down or forcing ourselves to feel a certain way. We kind of have to find a way to, like, ease into it. And and when we do that, that really shifts the way that these parts of the brain can speak to each other and work together. Mm. But it's not something we can do by brute force.
Let's talk about some of the sort of payoffs that we see with people who are regularly meditating or even in their short-term studies. What's the relationship between learning to pay that kind of attention to something like breath or other practices and emotions? How does it change people's emotional lives?
One of the first things that happens sort of is just people becoming more aware of their emotions. Mm-hmm. And I think it shouldn't be understated how important that is. Having worked clinically, I think one of the things I've noticed, and something that always comes to mind, I ran an anger management group for some veterans. Mm. And one of the things I commonly saw was that the veterans sort of would experience any kind of elevation or arousal as anger.
Uh-huh.
So it could be anticipation. It could be some level of anxiety or even enthusiasm or excitement. But they didn't have the ability to differentiate that.
So they didn't have a way to place a word or a label upon this inchoate feeling that they
any
had.
Any sense of kind of agitation or worked up or kind of energy was just anger. And so I use this as an example because oftentimes we don't have the subtle awareness of different emotions and how they feel in our body.
And how they are things in our body, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we may kind of have them as abstract concepts in our mind, but we don't know what that feels like in the body. And so I think as we're becoming more aware of what's going on in the body, we're also then becoming more aware of, well, what do different emotions, what do different thoughts, what's the impact they have on us? And so one of the things we see is that people start to generate greater awareness of different types of feelings, emotions, sensations, thoughts, and you develop a different relationship to them, which is to say, our kind of natural state of being is that anything that we don't like, we want to go away, and anything we really like, we want to keep and hold on to it. We want it to stay forever.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really work, you know? And so the changing relationship is kind of one of coming to recognize that everything comes and everything goes. And it's this state of equanimity or a lack of attachment. Things become less sticky.
That's a really nice
image. So you get lost or caught up in thoughts or emotions.
Yeah.
And that means sort of that it's okay to be a bit angry, but it's also okay to be a bit sad. Because that's just what happens. That's part of being human.
And it will change, you're saying?
It'll change.
That will change.
So one of the biggest findings we see is that there's this notion of decentering, of people kind of disconnect from the narrative or the story of that's part of me, that that's me and that will always be me. Mm. And this idea of, well, that's me right now, but in this moment now that's followed on from that last moment, that may not be me. And that ability to allow the narrative of who I am to evolve is a really important benefit for a lot of people because they get maybe a bit of freedom, if you want to use that term, to kind of redefine who they are.
I came across this word in reading some of the studies around this to prepare for the event of being over-identified. And I thought, I think I know exactly what that looks like. And what you're describing there is that what that is, that over-identification where you think it's not just there's some anger here, I can see it. It's like, I'm angry and I'm an angry person and that's who I am.
Yeah, at a really basic level in psychology, I mean, when John Gottman, who is this amazing therapist for couples and did couples therapy stuff, would often talk about this idea that it's really unhelpful to say to someone, you make me angry. Mm. And the work that he did was to say, it's not the person that makes you angry, it's the behavior of that person. Mm. And it's that insight that is
just
also what's happening
up some space
here.
There, aren't
exactly.
You?
It's not the person, it's not the fact that you're here, that you're an entity that makes me angry. Mm. It's something specific you've done. Mm. And disconnecting those two things is really helpful, right? Because if you make me angry, what do I do with that? Mm. I have to get away from you.
Yeah.
If something you've done makes me angry, well, then I just need to figure out a way to change that. And that also applies internally, right? If I have done something bad, if I think of myself as a bad person, how do I fix that? Mm. If I think I'm fundamentally bad, I have a problem. But if I recognize that I've just done something or I'm just feeling a certain way now, that's not me, it won't be me forever. It's okay. And the freedom and the space that that gives you is amazing, right? It's sort of the idea that sort of I'm not going to be this way forever. This is just part of who I am right now and what I'm feeling right now.
And so you're saying that these practices, like these meditation practices, can bring that sense of freedom, that sense of openness or decentering, I think is the word.
They can do. I think one of the challenges is, again, as I would say, sort of you can't force your way into it.
Right.
And I think the problem is that many people come to the practice desperately wanting these experiences, wanting that release, wanting that relaxation. Mm. And I think the unfortunate reality of the practice is that it's really hard work. Mm. And one of the things that happens in the mindfulness-based and the Jon Kabat-Zinn sort of versions of things is that you have to come into it with curiosity and openness.
Yeah.
And John would even talk about this idea of like you let go of your intentions.
Mm.
And it's only kind of ironically by letting go of the idea that I can relax and not be attached to things that I actually achieve it. And that's
it's very dissatisfying
as an idea.
It's very paradoxical, right? It's very, a lot of the, you know, Shunryo Suzuki and some of the Zen, this idea that as soon as you start thinking about it as being a thing, it's got goals, it's not going to work. And yet at the same time, you've got to make the effort. So that's it's quite a difficult balance.
It is a challenge, right? Because, you have to find a way to make the effort to do it, but you have to do it in such a way that you're prepared to just be open to whatever arises.
Mm.
And so I think for a lot of people, that's kind of not worth the payoff because it's like, I don't know what the payoff will be.
Yeah.
So you're telling me I have to sign up for this practice that I'm going to do every day for 15, 20 minutes instead of something else I could be doing, and I don't really know what's going to happen.
I've just got to be open and see
what happens. Have to see what happens. Yeah. Like, it feels like a bit of a risk and it sort of doesn't advertise well, right? So like, I think, you see a lot of the apps and programs, they're not going to market that side of things because it's not going to sell.
Yeah, $25 a month for something, I'm not sure what. Yeah.
Something interesting, you may like it, you may not, but
Let's
take it or leave it.
Just briefly, I know that you've done a lot of work and you're very interested in the darker side of these sorts of practices and you've talked about this opening up some space and not identifying with your emotions. But these feelings can also become quite extreme, can't they? Or what are some of the dangers of contemplative practice?
So I think when you make space, when you create an openness for things to come up, things will come up. And I think the things that often do come up are the things you least want to come up, right? So you think about how much time you spend in your day-to-day life distracting yourself, coming up with activities to take you away from things you don't want to think about. Mm. The difficulty of the meditation space is that you're basically trying to let go. You're opening up to kind of all kinds of things. Mm. And so the things that come up for a lot of people are things they really don't want to think about. They flood to the surface. Things maybe they haven't thought about for years, decades. Mm. So the most common negative experiences for people are terrible memories coming back from a long time ago, or intense anxiety, or experiences of depression. Mm. So I think it's a bit ironic that we often advertise mindfulness or meditation as a method of managing mental health, but it can actually exacerbate or create new problems with mental health. Mm. And the challenge is that if people don't know what to do with that, and they don't know what to make of it, right? So these experiences occur in our recent data in 50 to 60% of people. So it's not, really this is not a rare thing. Like, this is actually the norm. Mm. Most people will have these kinds of experiences. Now, it only causes problems, or it only interrupts people's day-to-day lives for about 10% of people. Mm. So it's a common experience, but it doesn't disrupt everyone's life. Mm. The challenge, though, is how do you work with it when it happens? And I think you heard a little bit earlier in the conversation with Jess and this discussion of, can you do this on your own? Mm-hmm. The challenge, I think, is if you're doing it on your own and you've never thought about kind of these feelings you have or the history you have or the trauma you've experienced, it's really hard to know what to do with that. Mm-hmm. And so this increasing trend towards people practicing on their own with apps, watching YouTube videos, reading books, without communities to support them, it's not a bad thing per se, but it does mean when these things come up for them, they don't necessarily have people to talk to about it. Yeah. So they're becoming more aware of things without necessarily then having the resources they need to address them. Yeah. They don't have to go wrong, and often they don't necessarily go wrong, but 10% of people is not a small number.
Sure. Sounds to me like this is a psychological and emotional challenge, but it's also a philosophical one, because the sense of who you are and what it means to be a self is also kind of being opened up with these sort of experiences, right?
I mean, many practices sort of really explore the core of that idea of what does it mean to be who you are.
Do I really exist?
Yeah, or there's lots of koans that sort of will encourage you to ask about, you know, who you are. There's one that I particularly like where you just ask the question, what is this, over and over until your brain can't give you an answer back.
Yeah, you're
and there's a brief moment.
Your brain.
there's a brief moment of peace.
Yeah.
You know, like very brief, very faint, where your mind just kind of goes, I have no more answers, and it's just kind of like blah, brain fart. Exactly. And you're like, wow, that was really cool. Mm. But the interesting thing that happens in that is sort of you keep asking these questions, you keep trying to figure out where you are, where do I locate myself? What part of me is me? If I cut off bits of my body, am I still me? Mm. If I take this part away or that part away, which bit was me? Mm. And you come up with an often very unsatisfying answer of none of it. And so if you've never really played with that idea philosophically, it can actually be quite terrifying. Mm. And so many people coming from a very often dualistic Cartesian kind of traditions where there's a sense of there is a permanent me that will always be around, this idea is incredibly challenging, right? If you have this deep felt sense of I will always be around in some sense,
core, the self that keeps going.
Exactly. There's some core me that will continue on in perpetuity, but then you're now playing with this idea of, well, if there is no core me, what will continue? And so that is something that is really challenging. And there are ways within certain meditation communities that are kind of built in to manage that, but it's kind of the thing that you want to ramp up to. Right. You know, it's kind of like you don't want to jump into the ocean.
You don't go straight to the headless stuff.
No, exactly. You don't want to jump into the ocean for your first swimming lesson, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's a really bad way to learn to swim.
Yeah, it's brutal. Yeah. How intrinsic do you think it is to have values and or ethics or relationship goals, if you like, goals in the way that we relate to other people in these sorts of practices? What does it look like if you don't have those? I mean, is it absolutely essential or not? I know you've thought quite a bit about this, Nick, in terms of like we extract these practices and we administer them as kind of a public health service outside of their traditional settings. And Are there things that are being lost there? Are there concerns that you have about that?
The reason we've kind of extracted them is we think that they have some sort of therapeutic potential, and there is sort of utility to training the mind and sort of developing an ability to sort of to focus and sustain attention. But the question that I often raise is, what is it ultimately in service of? What are we trying to get to? And so, you know, if it's kind of minimizing or reducing anxiety or depression in a particularly acute, bad way where someone's quite unwell, I don't necessarily have a problem with that. Mm. But what's challenging is when we go beyond that. So there's, you know, mindfulness training in the military as an example. Mm. And that's a really challenging one. And a number of researchers in the mindfulness community, I think, have really struggled with this idea of mindfulness in the military. I think one of the reasons why we struggle with it is because no one necessarily has an issue with looking after the soldiers.
Of course, yeah.
But what if we're making more efficient killers?
Mm.
So is that the same kind of mindfulness that was taught in these traditions where the fundamental principles were first do no harm to others or do this for the benefit of all beings? Mm-hmm. So that's where I think this becomes really challenging. Or another example where it's really challenging is when, say, Amazon, the corporation, brings in Zen booths into their warehouses. So for folks who don't know the backstory, Amazon was having issues with its employees. They had a lot of write-ups in the news, and employees were basically complaining of the fact that they didn't have enough time to go to the toilet. And so they basically were having to use water bottles to relieve themselves while they were doing their shift work. And Amazon thought in their wisdom, what if we gave them Zen booths? Because that will really fix the problem, right? They have these booths where they can go in and they have nice music and positive affirmations, because that's what everyone who wants a toilet break really needs, right? A Zen booth. So the issue sort of then is, well, what is this in service of? What are we trying to do? And there the argument is, well, that's clearly not meeting the need where it's at.
Mm.
Trying to make a more productive worker is kind of at odds with what the practices are all about. And so I think that's the challenge we face when we take these things out of their context is, it's not so much that I would say we have to kind of keep them in that context, mm-hmm. but it's that we need to recognize that the context that they come from is a particular container for the practice. And with that container comes a particular worldview and a particular set of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know that we necessarily need to abide by that worldview, sure. or that set of ethics. I often say to people, I highly doubt anyone practices meditation today the way the Buddha did.
Mm.
There's too many things that are different about the world. The Buddha may even not have been that nice of a guy for all we know.
Mm.
but there was this particular framework within which the practice was presented, and I think we need to explore that.
Yeah.
So what is this? What is the worldview that we're bringing to this?
Yeah.
And what is this practice in service of? What is the ethical commitment? Because if we don't consider that, then we're kind of leaving the door open to it being applied to anything and everything.
Mm.
And
as
I think
just
that's
a kind
where you
of
have problems.
Way of using the mind almost as a tool.
It just then becomes a tool or a technique that could be used in the service of something that we very fundamentally disagree with, and it could really harm people.
Well, that's something to end on, isn't it? Psychiatrist Nicholas Van Dam on the darker side of meditation and mindfulness practices. He is the director of the Contemplative Studies Centre and an associate professor in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. And you also heard today from meditation teacher Jess Hewan, who has written the short story collection The Dark Wet, which explores what it means to be human in a complex world. And our thanks to the wonderful host, Bridget Haynes, who is the co-founder and editorial director of Eon Media, which publish Eon and Psych magazines and bring you these Sophia Club events, live philosophy nights in London, in New York, and I'll be hosting one of their Melbourne events again this year, I think. Thanks to the team at the Brunswick Ballroom and ABC sound engineer Matthew Crawford. Leaving you with some experimental music performed on the night by musician, composer and percussionist Matthias Shack Arnott. I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can find and follow Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app. And outside of Australia, find us on most podcast apps. And if you want to join me at a live Big Ideas event in person, just head to our homepage, scroll on down and look for Be In Our Audience. Lots coming your way. Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.